This is Robert Cappuccio. Welcome to the Self-Help Antidote, a weekly dose of reason, perspective, and insight, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore authentic strategies and insights around personal transformation. Our commitment to you is to bring you some of the world's leading experts in the domains of fitness, wellness, coaching, and behavior change, separating fact from fallacy.
Johnny Sinclair, what's going on?
How are you doing, bud? Happy to be
doing
here.
Doing okay. Well, this has been a long time coming. We've been threatening each other about getting on the show and having a conversation and going back and forth. And I think the amount of conversations we had about having a conversation, we could have done five shows already. So it's like, okay, just show up, throw the mic on and see what John Sinclair has to say. For those of you who don't know, Johnny is brilliant. He's like, you know, I'm going to let you talk about it in a minute, but he's worked at so many different levels within health and fitness. We've been friends ever since the PTA Global days. I think even before that, it just seems like you're one of those people who have always been around in my life. I don't really know where our friendship began. It just seems like, luckily, you've always been here. Thanks for being here with us today, Johnny.
Oh, thank you for having me. And, you know, for most people probably don't know where we kind of got started. But for me, it was, yeah, that experience of becoming faculty for PTA Global. And that's where you, we can talk about this if you want to, but you made such a profound impact in my, not just in my career, but in my life. And that happened from us, you know, aligning and spending time together with PTA Global when we were going through building out that company.
No, thank you, Johnny, because I think everybody who came through that organization, and there's context to a lot of this, but made a profound difference in the lives of everybody else. So people who came through that instructor program,
and
you could tell, because even after, I mean, PTA Global still exists in one way, form or another, but after that whole time in our lives has ended, we've all progressed and evolved as friends ever since. So that says a lot. You know, it's not that I don't want to talk about the PTA Global days. It's just some of my listeners have said that, you know, whenever I talk about myself, we should title that episode "How to Cure Insomnia in Three Short Minutes." But I think what we wanted to talk about today was micro movement. Because I think there's a lot of powerful applications, especially in today's day and age, when people are saying more and more that everything seems additive and we're becoming increasingly distracted and increasingly time poor. Like, where do we start? Talk a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on right now that led us to this conversation. Is that a cool place to start?
Yeah, sure. Right now, I have a company called Seven Movements with my partner, Dan Tatton. It's in Canada. I'm in Sunrise, Florida, but our company's in Canada. And what we've done is over just the course of, you know, 11 years now, have really kind of honed in on this concept of microdosing movement as an application for people that don't exercise, right? They don't go to the gym. That's not a part of their lifestyle, but they know they need to, they just don't know how. And they're becoming increasingly frustrated as the years go by with the amount of disinformation out there, the amount of complexity that there is out there, not knowing where to start. And a lot of the leaders in our industry are constantly barraging the consumer with what is the right thing to do. And that became increasingly frustrating for us. The story really goes back about, you know, over 10 years ago, when Dan came to me. We were both working in at World Health in Edmonton. And actually right around the time that we were doing the PTA Global stuff. And he said to me, he's like, John, like, my grandma really wants to be able to exercise more. She's not going to go to the gym. She loves gardening. How could we get her healthy enough to spend time in the garden? As you know, in Canada, it's quite cold. So you've got 8 months of winter where people are pretty restless and just sitting still. And then when spring comes, it's all in. And so, you know, she wasn't able to tolerate the stresses that came from gardening and was getting pain, you know, suffering from pain. And, you know, I'm going to be out there for 8 hours and it's going to crush me, but I got to get the garden in. And so I just said, well, wouldn't it make sense that we prepared her for the sport of gardening? And he was like, well, that's interesting. I was like, because if you think about it, it's an activity that requires certain tasks, much like a sport. It's just has its different rules and different placement and different demands to it. So what if we created some preparatory activities that she could do for the sport of gardening and some recovery things that she could do, and we treat it like that? He's like, that's amazing. How many movements do you think we should prescribe? And I was like, well, let's do it in 7 movements. And that's where the company arose from. That's how we started the name of it.
And so 7 didn't evolve. You just started with that arbitrarily. You said 7 movements.
7. So it was a nice number, you know? And so what it ended up happening was we wrote a book, and it got picked up by the Royal Horticultural Society of the United Kingdom. And that gave us some momentum and allowed us to build a website. And we wrote another book about 7 movements to keep you healthy and pain-free in the office. And then that just kept evolving and evolving and evolving. And, you know, fast forward 10 years now, and we've really kind of honed in on this concept of microdosing movement, or what we're calling the micro movement method. And the idea behind it is, how do I give you smaller doses throughout the day that aggregate up into a bigger health outcome, but is purposeful and driven around the things that you love, right? It's not so much outcome based, like on the surface. It's, here's what I love doing. How do I make it easier for you to do that? And then we progress you through a strategy or a sequence that ladders up throughout the day to eventually, as we're hoping and we're starting to prove now, that it improves not only their ability to participate in the task pain-free, but it also leads to longer term health outcomes in the aggregate. So
James Petrasko, one of the founders of the Trans-Theoretical Model of Change, said that the problem with initiating behavior changes is a lot of times people legitimately do not know where to start. And I know for practitioners in the fitness industry, this is not a fitness podcast per se, but from working with a lot of practitioners, that seems outrageous, because we've been doing this so long and exercise and movement is a central tenet of our lives. It's like, of course, people know where to start. Well, no, they don't, because a lot of information is confusing. And a lot of it, to what you're saying, is even conflicting to an end user who's trying to interpret all of these seemingly, I'm not saying it is, but seemingly contradictory sources of information from people who kind of have the appearance of all being credible, which makes it even more confounding. You're saying that micro movements is, what can you do in small, palatable, accessible doses that's built upon something that pulls you into it? It's something that you enjoy, something you want to do, rather than push motivation where I got to constantly drive myself to do something that might not have immediate relevance. The payoff isn't in the process. It's for an outcome out there. This is wrapped around things that are not only relevant to what I need to do day to day, but what I want to do.
You nailed it. And what we had the same questions ourselves. We're like, do we even know if this will be effective? Right? Because as we're mapping it out, it made sense. It made people feel better in the interim. But just like everyone else, they want to go, well, is this even effective? How do we know? And so what we did is we didn't really stumble upon. We knew that there are researchers in this realm, Dr. Martin Gabala and Dr. Jonathan Little. Dr. Gabala is in McMaster University. He wrote the book, The 1 Minute Workout. And Dr. Jonathan Little is at UBC. And we aligned with these guys and we said, hey, this is what we're doing. Would you want to partner in this idea of us coming up with microdosing movement, or as they term them, exercise snacks, and us find some purposeful ways, but also do it for purposeful populations? So we started looking at, well, what is it that the rare disease community needs? So people that want to prevent cancer or going through cancer treatment, folks that have type 2 diabetes, people with Parkinson's. And we said, well, here's a group of people in this population that aren't served typically by the fitness industry. We kind of skirt around things and try to help them. But what if we were to able to measure this idea of microdosing movements and to give them strategies and tools that would actually make their day better? And so that was what we started doing. And so we partnered with UBC and McMaster, and we're running studies, and we build out the tech with our company 7 Movements, and we deliver the research right to people in their right in their hands in their homes. So they're not lab rats. They're not 20-year-olds. They're people that have onset of diabetes or diabetes, they get this this program built into them where they just follow along with me in these microdose movements, and we measure the outcomes. We gather the data, we measure the outcomes before and after, and we try to infer or create a feasibility study that will allow them to go, well, this is a strategy that could be employed by the medical community at large, rather than just the fitness industry.
Well, it's a conundrum for both. Like, how do you get people to do the things that they know that they should do? It's just such a high barrier to entry. And that is perplexing. So I remember, you know, since we brought PTA Global, it's on my mind. I remember the second meeting of the minds that we did right here in San Diego, actually. And when I had mentioned that every year it was, you know, I was just talking about the US. I know this audience is international, but I said, well, we're spending $280 billion a year on the healthcare industry, or more appropriately, the sick care industry. And people in the audience kind of like gasped. They had this astonished look on their face. Well, that was back in 2010. How are we doing? We're approaching $5 trillion a year. So what was obviously unsustainable and seemingly outrageous back then has exploded to levels that none of us, I wouldn't have believed you if you told me in 2010 that in 2024 we would be sitting around those numbers, that it would grow so exponentially. And back then, 80% of all of the illnesses that we were dealing with were lifestyle related. That's even expanded a little bit. So we have this outrageous, almost inconceivable annual cost of healthcare, with the vast majority of these issues being behavioral. And we still haven't gotten a handle on what exactly do we do. And that's astonishing. Do you remember Scott Hobson at the end of every apprenticeship? He would sit down and he would do the best, worst, and most surprising.
Yeah, of course.
I love that. And I use that all the time still to this day.
Me too. Let's
do that here. What is the most encouraging thing that you've discovered in the research that you're taking part in related to micro movements?
So, and this, we had an assumption that this might happen, but this blew us away. So the adherence of people to the study, those people doing it, was 94%. So in most research studies, right, if you can get to 60%, you've crushed it, right? We had a 94% adherence rate to the first study that we did. That means that they were engaged in the process and it was something that they could tangibly do, which to us was like, okay, did they get the VO2 max improvements that we were hoping? No. But more importantly, they did it.
That is more important, because if successful adherence to goals dramatically increases success in consecutive goals. So it's a major predictor. I mean, it's almost like, you know, those apps where if you have a dollar and you spend 75 cents, the other 25 cents goes into an investment. It's like, okay, I'm investing like 25 cents a day, 50 cents a day. What does that do? It does a lot, because at some point you'll start to look at yourself as being someone who's financially conscientious and an investor. And starting from there, that can get into like $10, $20, a couple of hundred. You can actually start to accelerate to where you're investing a few grand every single month because you started with just 25 cents. I think people underestimate that. And that's a major stumbling block. So 94% adherence is astonishing. Is it because of the accessibility? Is it because the movements are aligned with what people enjoy or self-select? Or is it a combination of multiple variables?
I think it's a combination of multiple. And we structured the our research app to do a couple things. One, I mean, in a research study, you have a control group. So there was a group that was doing more mobility-related strategies. And then we had ones that were doing a cardiovascular strategy. In our commercial app, what we've found is that they get the autonomy to choose what they want based on their tolerance of what they can handle that day. So they go in and they answer a few questions, and then that will spit out what their doses will be as a prescription. And then they have the opportunity to do those throughout the day. Now, the goal of completing them throughout the day, which is what we measured in the study and how we got this adherence number is if you got through all of them that improved your streak, right? And people don't want to break their streak. Once they get on a streak, the last mm-hmm. thing you want to do is break it, right? Like I measure my heart rate variability and I'm almost on, I think I've got maybe 5 days where I haven't not measured my heart rate in 4 years. I haven't missed a day in 4 years, right? So this is just now what I do. It's almost, you know, I wake up in the morning and like a zombie, I go out there and strap my heart rate on. I don't even know I'm doing it, right? At this point. And that's kind of what we're trying to measure is what is the minimal amount of dose that we can get somebody to make an active change and move towards a streak with purposeful, intentional activities that they value, not what I value, but what they value. And so that they now can make that change in their life and maybe ladder it up into doing more, right? So it starts as a micro dose, and then those doses just improve over time to the point where they're craving more. And that's what the feedback we got was, they're like, well, can we do more? Can we do more?
That's what people don't understand about behavior change. I got that question in a seminar about a week ago with learning and development. It's like, you're telling me to take time out of my day. I don't even have 5 minutes in my day to engage in skill development and reading. And it's like, well, I think the harsh side of my comment, which I understand, I'm highly empathetic that what I'm saying is out of context for a lot of people. But if 10 minutes a day of skill development is additive, think about the pain, frustration, and anxiety of unpreparedness as the world changes in ways you couldn't possibly predict. Because it used to be like, well, we learn the lessons from the past. Well, as a society, not really. But we should learn the lessons from the past to prepare ourselves in the present to be able to predict the future. The world is changing so much that the lessons from the past might not even be relevant. They might actually be damaging. But the other side of that was what you think is additive, do anything, follow your interests, follow your curiosity, because what you said was critical. You kind of get on a streak where you don't want to break that pattern because that pattern means something to you and it says something about you. It's starting to shape your identity. I mean, going back into my bodybuilder days when I was like, God, I was even dumber than I am now. Not saying bodybuilders are dumb, but this one was, where I was obsessive about everything. And I would start on a quote unquote diet. And for the first 7 days, all I would think about is bagels. I would try to incorporate bagels into every conversation, no matter what the context of the conversation was. But then after a few weeks, I remember my girlfriend woke me up in the middle of the night once. Because I had such momentum behind me, I just wasn't deviating at all. And she thought that like I was just like getting a little bit too obsessive. I remember she woke me up in the middle of the night and she was like straddling me. Her knees were on my shoulders and she was force feeding me cake. Now, we had a very dysfunctional relationship, obviously, but that's kind of how people get what you think is additive becomes non-negotiable at another part of your life. Where if you're just doing anything and then somebody comes back and says, give me more, you have absolutely won. That's astonishing. Yep. I love that. What was disappointing? What were you hoping to discover that you didn't?
We wanted to discover that smaller doses of activity done at a vigorous intensity would yield improvements in VO2 max. That didn't happen. And there's probably a number of reasons why. Number one, the tasks that I gave them were more functional in nature. So the amount of cardiorespiratory response that would come from, you know, moving in different directions with a little bit more complexity may not yield an immediate change in cardiovascular response because, you know, that task is maybe new to that particular person, and or their perception of vigorous is different because it's more of a motor skill, right? So we didn't keep things very linear and very known and things that we could, you know, they weren't on a bike, right? So they were doing, when I say cardiovascular exercise, they were doing task-based multi-directional movements. They weren't on a wind gate and hit it for 30 seconds as hard as you can. That we knew we could improve cardiorespiratory fitness. But I think us knowing that this is a task that needs to be coached, and it needs to be coached with a level of relevance that somebody can attach an understanding of how hard do I need to go here to get the outcome that we're looking for. And so I think as an exercise physiologist researcher, they would get really nerdy and geeky about that VO2 max change, right? Whereas, you know, the coach in me gets more excited at the fact that they completed the task, right? And they adhered to it and they did it multiple times.
Okay, this I want to talk about a little bit because you're talking about motor learning and development in the early stages of an exercise program. So you're sitting in front of 200 salespeople that work for a health club chain, and you ask the question, what is one factor that drives the decision to either start an exercise program, in this context by joining a health club, or not? And they will say almost unanimously, in one way, shape, or form, goal achievement. Someone has a goal and they want to achieve it, and they're talking about a tangible, outwardly observable change. Talk about what some of the misconceptions are about that and why that might not be the best framework for gauging success and progression. Because I think this is important.
Yeah, I think the challenge with coming up with a, you know, some folks have said a big, hairy, outrageous goal that you just have to like get obsessive about and all your daily activities are going to be driven around this goal doesn't work. It works for you and I and all of us that work in the fitness industry because we're freaks. That aligns with who we are as people, right? Fitness to us makes sense. Fitness does not make sense to my mom, right? Like the whole concept behind it, that doesn't create a picture in her head of fun. It doesn't create a picture in her head of safety, that this is an environment that I want to go do this in. So the challenge is that, well, yeah, mom wants to get healthier. She wants to have a healthier heart, but she's not going to put herself in a situation where she doesn't feel safe, secure, trusted, and then put all your insecurities about how you're currently feeling in the hands of people that you don't know in an environment that you don't want to be in. And then think that that's going to be there. Like how many consultations have we done collectively in our career? Tens, hundreds, thousands. And I would
can't count.
Venture to guess that most of those people have kind of like interviewed themselves on what they think they need to say to the trainer across from the table or the membership consultant, because they don't want to be seen as wrong. But yet those answers that they're giving them when somebody asks them the question, they're not congruent with what that person's truly feeling because they just don't want to feel wrong, right?
Don't send me on a tangent.
I'm going to tell you the things that you're going to want to hear to make me feel like we can build a rapport and then we'll be able to move on. And then the reality is then the environment doesn't match the desire of the person or the value system of the person first and foremost. It doesn't, the programming certainly doesn't, right? Like the fitness programming is getting worse in the fitness industry. I'll come out and I'll stick my throat out there and get it slit by everybody, but it doesn't match those people. And that's what we did is we said, our company has to be about serving the 80% or more, probably more now, that aren't using the gym, and completely change the programming in that we have to give you doses that you can tolerate in ways that you're going to actually do them in order for you to make that jump and become the freaks like us that truly go, this is what life is all about. Life is about movement for us now, you know?
You know, John, one of the things I've always appreciated about you back in the PTA Global days, but also frustrated me about you, is you'll casually have a conversation, and within that conversation, you'll say five things that are so massively important casually and just keep moving on. It's like, whoa, 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 stop, slow down, wait. Like I remember, and we're not going to get into this, but we were talking about the interview of the coaching process. of the PDQ, I believe, program design questionnaire, which was kind of not really a coaching process, but it was a way to navigate through the goals, needs, wants, and abilities of the person in front of you. And you had said something about voice inflections. Like the person should really monitor their voice inflections to kind of like not lead the witness. Mm-hmm. And you just moved on. And I remember thinking, wait, come back to this. There's so much in what you just said that kind of reminds me of those days. One, where people talk about coaching as if you ask somebody, and asking an average person this that isn't connected to coaching and getting this response, okay, that's illuminating. Asking someone who feels that they're in the coaching space, but not really, who responds this way is terrifying. Where one of the main value propositions of a coach is, I hold you accountable. It's like, oh my days, that is so destructive. No. You create the context and the guiding principles and the intrinsically generated rules by which your client is accountable to themselves. They're never accountable to you. If you're holding someone accountable, you're going to get false inputs. I'm going to tell you what I think you want from me. It's not that I'm lying to you and I'm sitting here telling you what I think you want to hear. I'm telling you who I think I should be based on your worldview, which is completely non-sustainable for long-term change. That's first. Second thing is, if you do anything in the gym, as long as it's not dangerous, anything that you enjoy that's sustainable, that encourages consecutive visits with consistency, and not even a gym, to wherever your arena is, whether that's out in a field, in a playground, whatever. I know Singapore started building workout structures in playgrounds so people could just like walk by, go to the park, and easily access some form of physical activity, which is brilliant. It shifts your identity and your level of efficacy simultaneously. So it dramatically increases the chances that what you're doing on day three will lead to activity on day 33 and 333, at which point you're probably not going to go back to inactivity unless something tragic and dramatic happens to you. Another thing that you're talking about that really catches my attention is, like, this goes back to Moritani and DeVry in 1979 when they started looking at this, and the fitness industry, we would teach this but then ignore it, is within the first 4 to 8 weeks, you're going through neurological changes in motor learning. So what is all this muscle-specific, goal-specific training when you're in a neural adaptation phase? And I think you were talking about that a little bit. Could you go back to that? It's like, I joined a gym and somebody's like, okay, here's the plan. So you can lose as much fat and build muscle within the first 30 days. I haven't exercised since I was in high school, which was, I don't know, when Kurt Cobain was alive.
Right. Yeah. And it's sad because we get this misinformation that you talked about earlier, where programming is, you know, I give you an input, there's an automatic output. And we just know that that's not true, that, you know, there's a stage of learning that exists for every individual. Everyone's going to adapt to a stimulus at a different rate. We know this, and we know it from people that don't exercise. And we even know it through adolescent athletes that I spend a lot of time coaching. Like, they could be on the exact same program and someone gets really fast, really quick, and another one stays clumsy for 3 more months. You know, you never know when it's going to click, but eventually it's going to click. And that level of neural adaptation means that they're in a study, is you want to try and control as many things as possible. But the one thing that is impossible to control is individuality. Like, that's just a construct of research that you have to chalk up. It's going to work for some and it's not going to work for everybody. And that's okay. The nice part about research is that as they say, with what is it, Occam's razor, you can thinly slice it and say, well, we did this. Now let's just try this. Now let's just try this. And you can just keep building on that in a way that creates efficacy to the purpose and intention behind why we're doing all this to begin with. The challenge that we have in our industry is that, and there's a death in the continuing education world right now. Personal trainers aren't investing in education. Employers certainly are not. And people are looking for information in the shortest soundbite as possible, which is generally YouTube or wherever else you can find it, right? Maybe a podcast. And they're looking for what's the simplest little thing that I could do that's going to yield the maximum amount of result. And that's what our challenge has been with microdosing is how do I take the minimal amount of dose and then give it to you over a period of time to see an outcome. When we manifest this idea of outcomes needing to be the sole purpose of what we're doing and results and gains and all these things, what it does is it minimizes the effectiveness of the process and just going through it a little bit at a time. And so I think that's where we need to get to as an industry is like you said, is championing the idea of just get started, just dip your toe in the water, just get it going. And I'm here with you every step of the way, because if you have somebody that you can hold their hand through the process and just be so happy that they kept their streak alive, regardless of how perfect it was or how imperfect it was, like you said, the nervous system will get smart and tuned to it, and you become a blacksmith that can hammer a piece of metal and never hurt themselves because the body will self-organize a way in order to be able to continue to do something as long as there's purpose behind me doing it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
So the way that we look at results and consume information, or even the way that we view mastery, has changed. And I think one of the things that you're saying is that's dangerous because our expectations are altered in a way that does not support long-term adherence. Actually, let me just go back and say, I had said something earlier about Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. So for a lot of our listeners, Nirvana was a band in the 1990s. Kurt Cobain was the lead singer of Nirvana. And the 1990s was an ancient measurement of time used by old people before the emergence of the 21st century. Okay, great. So now that we've covered that, let's move forward. So when you have altered expectations, and I expect one thing to happen, but another thing happens, and it's not surprising, it's not better, it's worse, I lose motivation. I lose motivation because I negatively alter my dopamine levels, which is problematic. Psychologically, I view a success as a failure. And if I'm attached to that, I view myself as a failure when I've actually succeeded based on what is physiologically possible. I just don't realize it.
Yeah. Well, I think you said something profound in one of the mentorships that it made me laugh, but also was like, yeah, why are we approaching the idea of success with goal setting being on a number, or I got to get to this, or I've got to do that? And I remember one you said, you know, a common goal that we have is, well, I want to lose 20 pounds before this wedding. And you said, why is there a weight restriction at the wedding? Like, why do you need to lose 20 pounds for the wedding? Is it actually the number?
I have to.
Or is it that you want to feel confident, right? And so it's
an old building. There's a weight limit capacity.
Yeah. you're on a floating gazebo, and there's only certain odd people like
you're afraid the flows won't hold.
Yeah. And so it made me think differently about how do we ask the question about what is the actual goal, but it not related to the outcome, it more related to the process. Because if I can get somebody to feel confident, confident just in movement changes the game. Like if I take a young athlete that's tore his ACL and I'm helping him get back and return to sport, they're not concerned about what weight they're pushing. They're concerned about how do I be successful on the field so that I can perform with my peers and not let them down. Like, that is their goal. Your goal is to build confidence in people, right? And so how do I structure that question? This is a question to you, Bobby. How would you structure the question to be more related around confidence in the process opposed to the outcome itself?
I think part of that answer, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to answer that. And all of the answers have an element of value and an element of, well, in a different context, you might be wrong. However, I think one of the things that we did back at PTA Global was we understood a couple of things. One, whatever expectation you set through how you communicate, because of primacy, that's what's going to be most important to that person. So a lot of times you're setting the expectations that they're now confined within. So another thing to keep in mind is temporal discounting. We understand that the further out a result is in the future, the less emotional value we place on it. And no matter what we say about commitment and reason and discipline over emotion, you're setting yourself up for failure. So yes, talk about, so how everything layers is first, what's meaningful to you? Because weight loss is not about weight loss. Weight loss is about maybe being able to do something in the world, being able to experience something, being able to be a certain type of someone, or avoid the other end of that. Avoid being like dad who couldn't go out and couldn't engage and kind of was miserable and kind of was depressed because his life shrunk and it was limited, either because of choices he made or other factors affecting himself. I don't want to let that happen to me. Regardless, what is meaningful to you? What's your vision of what that looks like in the future? And a lot of times when people craft a vision, it's about something I'm going to bring forth or something I'm going to achieve. Where what I'm talking about here is, what are the things that you are going to do or not do? So 6 months from now, when you are living your values, engaging in things that give you life for their own sake, like when I go out on a dinner date with my wife, I'm not trying to achieve something. It's like there's an outcome. The payoff is in the process of whatever occurs between us when we're out. So my vision for the future is I want to be able to do that a few more nights a week. Why? Because it makes my life worth living and I feel more alive when I engage in it. Okay, well, based on where you are now and what you want for your vision, what are the things that have to occur? What are some outcomes? And now, in order to drive those outcomes, what are certain behaviors? And I think the key is describing that and then reverse engineering it. Because I talked about meaning leading to vision and vision leading to, well, what outcomes need to ensue? Okay, what behaviors do I need to take? Well, you kind of know a lot of times within organizational coaching if what you're recommending and your models really work if you can reverse engineer them. They're true in the reverse. If I engage in certain behaviors, I bring about certain outcomes that allow me to fulfill a vision for the future. So this way, my life is aligned with what's most meaningful to me. So either way you look at that, it's mutually reinforcing. I think that's a conversation we need to have. And now, okay, so what does success look like 6 months from now? Okay, next week. How do we know if this is working? And not just the input from the trainer or the guide or the coach or your manager of your department, but from the person who is actually engaging in this process. And what does it look like today? What does success look like today? Because I don't think anybody would reasonably go, well, if I could lose 5 pounds like today, okay, here, give me a saw. We'll cut your foot off. Done.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of weight? Like a 5 pound foot? Is that like a really large foot? I'm trying to think about like how much does the foot weigh?
Right. Yeah, I can't answer that.
But that's the only way. So nobody would reasonably say, well, weight loss is the goal for today. No, no. What do you have to know? What do you have to do? How do you have to engage within the next 23, 15, 10 hours, 45 minutes that we're together? For you to walk out of here or for you to go to bed tonight knowing this was a success, because efficacy supports efficacy. I don't know if that's the right answer, but that's my answer for sitting here right now.
Oh, I love it, because the way that I've, and the way that I've structured many programs, I wrote all the wellness and health experience on the Ritz-Carlton Yacht Collection. And so they have a brand new yacht. I had to build out all the classes for a calendar year. And I was like, well, how am I going to guess or program for people I don't know, mm-hmm. for an experience that isn't really going to be proven? The only thing that I can really attach it to is, how would you like to feel by, as a result of finishing this particular session? And I built the programming around that. So the intake was, well, if, you know, I'm kind of tired and I'm not really feeling all that great, I'd need to do something that's kind of going to build me up. Or, you know what, I was just at St. Bart's and I was out shopping all day. I need to do some recovery because I've been walking up and down this mountainous island for a while. There needs to be a recovery process in place. So the way I built the programming was all around, well, how do you feel now? And how would you like to feel by the end of it? And I think that can be our approach in coaching exercise.
Well, there's also immediate transference. Because another tangible question is, what's the most important? I remember this from PTA Go. What's the most important thing you have to do today? Why is that significant? Now, that could be, I'm going home to be with my kids. It's significant because, well, hopefully I love my kids. I haven't seen them all day. Or I'm going into a major meeting, and how my presentation goes has an impact on my family's future and well-being and my level of status. Am I standing within the organization? Well, how do you feel right now versus how do you want to feel? Walking into the meeting, how you feel right now, what's likely to happen? Paint me a picture. Now, the way you want to feel leaving here in that mental, emotional state, what is different in how that presentation goes and the consequences? So if I'm like really frustrated and I'm distracted and I'm irritable, but I walk out of here not feeling elated, inspired, but on a level 8 irritation, a level 2 that's manageable. Now, talk to me in real terms about what the most important thing today is and how that's going to compound into your future. So now you've created a tangible, meaning-based result right now versus 6 months from now. 100%. Like that is so absolutely critical.
Yeah. And the feedback that we got was outstanding. Like Forbes came in, did an audit of what we did, and we got 5 out of 5 by Forbes magazine, just the programming at the wellness. So the feedback we got from the ladies and gentlemen that were attending the classes was outstanding. One, we had a terrific coach. His name was Boban Pecic. He was from Serbia. And this guy, like, he knows the game inside out and backwards, and he knows how to deliver that experience. So programming is part of it, but coaching and being able to deliver on that is, it's the missing link, right? As we say all the time, it's the art form of delivering the program that really connects with people. The other thing that that you commented on that I think is crucially important and why we built it into 7 Movements in our app was, when working with Parkinson's patients, like, there's tons of money going into research for Parkinson's, but to find a cure for Parkinson's, not necessarily to help people deal with the symptoms that they have as a result of having Parkinson's disease, like right now. So what we did is we took a focus group of a bunch of people that had Parkinson's, and we just asked them the questions. What are things that you would love to be able to do right now that you're currently not doing? And one that jumped out at me that I never really considered, because I was thinking more movement-like stuff, was, I'd like to be able to write handwritten notes or use or identify with my own penmanship. And I was like, yeah, I guess. Like, that's something I wouldn't really think about. It's a fine motor skill. But if I have a tremor in my hand, I don't recognize my penmanship, then I don't want to do that skill because it reminds me that I have Parkinson's. So I said to them, just right off the cuff, I said, hey, let's try something, because I have a theory about Parkinson's. And it's probably not my theory, it's just something that popped into my head. And that is that it's a neurological output of interference that's happening. And if I give it a different input, perhaps the brain recognizes that input and delays the output from the task that I kind of want to do. So that was my theory behind building this program for them. So I said, take out a piece of paper and write a 15-word sentence. Doesn't matter what it is, just write it, but you know, with pencil and paper. And they did that. I said, let's just give you a different input. So, you know, we did some sensory stuff. I had them slap their hand. I had them shake their hands really quick, do a couple vestibular changes for the brain. And then they went back and they wrote the name. 100% of the people that were in that focus group saw an improvement in the clarity of their penmanship. They wrote faster. They wrote bigger. And they were like, there were people on the focus group crying. And I was like, that was just a simple strategy, but that'll be something they'll remember forever whenever they need to write. And that was the impetus behind us building out a Parkinson's toolkit for them, because it dealt with the now. It's not dealing with, I'm not going to be able to build a program for you that's going to cure Parkinson's disease, but I'm going to give you little things that you could do now that may or may not. It'll work for some, it'll work for others. Like some people find a hammer more valuable than a screwdriver, but I'm going to give you a particular tool and toolkit that is filled with a whole bunch of stuff that may improve your day in that particular moment to allow you to go live and do the things that you love doing. And that's really the whole essence behind what we've done.
Well, there's so much there. One is changing sensory input, positively altered efferent output. Wow. That's brilliant in and of itself. The second thing is the empathy around, you said, well, I would never even have thought that, but what is it like? What's really significant for someone with Parkinson's that you wouldn't even consider, and being present and imaginably being able to project yourself into that person's situation to the point where it allows you to utilize your expertise and how it moves you emotionally to take action. So it goes from empathy right into compassion, which allowed you to try that. And it's also a matter of someone listened to me and built something around me specifically for me. So my friend Nick sent me some research the other day, which was interesting, about how results people were achieving on an exercise program were related to how much that program was customized for them, even when it wasn't. It was the belief that it was customized. Now,
right.
Empirical evidence matters, competence matters, effectiveness matters, but also how you communicate and how it's framed around the recipient or the end user matters equally. Because when I read that, I was like, you know, this reminds me of Ellen Langer's research, where she took hotel staff from seven different hotel locations and helped a certain population identify that their daily activities made them more of an exerciser than someone who went to the gym 3 days a week.
Right.
And at the end of the month, they had their biometric changes were, they had not only lost weight, but their blood pressure decreased. It was amazing. So these people physically changed based on a belief that they had that I am an exerciser. And Aaliyah Crum, her research on ghrelin response to caloric intake, the person's belief about how many calories they were taking in profoundly affected up to threefold ghrelin release. So when somebody feels that they're being considered and what we're doing is built around them based on specific factors that are both unique and relevant to who they are as a person, that's critical. So before we wrap this up, and this conversation has been fantastic, let's get to most surprising. What did you find? I mean, I think what you were talking about with Parkinson's patients was very surprising for me. What did you find from your research that was most surprising? Like, wow, I did not expect that to happen.
I think maybe just seeing the parallels that happen between what you try to structure in a controlled environment and what we see in an uncontrolled environment, which is our daily lives, right? When it was purposeful and it connected with that person, like, this is what I need to do, and this is what I need to do to be healthier, and this is something that I can actually do, that it moved the dial on where they felt they needed to be at that moment. And I think intuitively we knew that that would happen, but to see the adherence rate and to see people ask for more and to see people who seemingly had the same outcome, we didn't measure the behavior side of it too much, but we saw that whether it was mobility or cardio, the same change in their behavior around the activity was the same, right? Like there wasn't like only 20% or 70% of the people that did cardio adhered to it, but 100% of the people that did mobility, like it was across the board the same. So it led me to believe that it's not necessarily what we're doing, it's that we're doing that is the most profound thing. And I think intuitively I knew it, but it just helped reinforce that. And we're hoping to replicate that with the rest of our studies, that we'll get some sort of correlation going on there.
So the relationship between two variables where perceived importance and confidence intersect,
yep,
had a higher impact on adherence than the type of exercise or modality.
Yeah, because
that's an amazing finding, isn't it?
They got to select the exercise. They even got to select what coach performed the exercise or like demonstrated the exercise. So within a particular movement that came up, they got to select which coach they want. Did they want a male coach or a female coach? Right. But it all came out to be the same. So that was really surprising to me too.
So, wow. That is so interesting. You know, Johnny, where can we get more information about you? Where can we reach out to you? Like, what's your mobile number? What's your home address?
Yeah, please come on over. My fridge is always stocked with beer. So come on over and we'll have a chat. You can reach me at my Instagram handle is at Authentic Health Coach. And then our 7 Movements company, it's at 7 Movements. Our website is www.7movements.com. And in the next 2 weeks, our commercial app should be ready. So by the time this is probably out, it's probably already out there. So you'd go to our website. If you go to our website, you can sign up for our newsletter. We give out like a healthy newsletter once a week that comes out on Mondays. And I put a little 7-minute morning, little tip in there of something to do for 7 minutes every morning to make you feel better. And along with a cascade of lots of different healthy information and research that's out there just to kind of give you some good news to read first thing on a Monday morning.
Thank you, Johnny. Loved having you here.
Oh, thanks for sharing your expertise and allowing me to share with your listeners, bud.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Visit us at theselfhelpantidote.com to share your feedback, insights, and recommendations on what topics you'd like us to explore in the future.